I want you to picture a scenario for a second. You're staring at a problem.
Right.
It could be, a massive bottleneck at work, or maybe a nagging health issue, or even just a communication breakdown in a relationship.
Sure. Happens to all of us.
Yeah. And well, you're an observant person, so you spot the exact metric that's going the wrong direction. You isolate the issue and you step in to fix it.
You apply some force.
Exactly. You
Yeah.
tighten the metaphorical leaky pipe. And for a second, like, the dripping actually stops. You fixed it.
Or so you think.
Right, because then almost immediately, the water heater in the basement just explodes.
Right.
The floorboards warp, and suddenly you have three new, incredibly expensive, entirely unpredictable catastrophes on your hands. And the question is, like, why does pushing harder to fix a system sometimes violently tear that entire system apart?
I mean, it really is the defining frustration of modern life.
Yeah.
We've been deeply conditioned, really for centuries, to believe that if we apply enough targeted, measurable force to a problem, well, we can control the outcome.
The whole cause and effect thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We think of the world as this intricate clockwork mechanism. But when you're dealing with the systems that actually govern our existence, the highly complex adaptive ones,
Yeah.
that mechanical logic doesn't just fall apart, it actively accelerates the failure.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because today's deep dive is into a piece of research that honestly completely shatters that clockwork illusion.
It really does.
We are looking at a paradigm-shifting paper. It's titled The Architecture of Viability: Navigating Complex Systems from Relational Closure to Global Coherence by Dr. Bechara Sawili.
And it is dense, but it is so important.
Super dense. But our mission today is to figure out exactly why complex systems fail, often while looking completely healthy right up until the moment they collapse.
Which is the scariest part, right?
Totally. And we're going to explore a mathematically proven framework for actually navigating them. So for everyone listening, we're going to start way down at the microscopic rules of how two single things interact, and we're going to build all the way up to 56-dimensional phase spaces.
I know that sounds intimidating,
Yeah.
but that journey is absolutely necessary because the core premise we're exploring today is that complex adaptive systems.
Which, let's just call them CAS moving forward to save time.
Good call. CAS do not fail because a single component breaks.
Yeah.
I mean, the broken water pump or the snapped gear, that's a mechanical failure mode.
Right.
Complex adaptive systems fail due to a widespread systemic loss of what Dr. Sawili calls relational coherence.
Relational coherence. Okay, I want to set the stage for you here. Because the way we currently judge the health of any system relies entirely on dashboards.
We love our dashboards.
We do. Think about it. You go to the doctor, they check your blood pressure, your heart rate. You sit in a corporate board meeting, you look at, key performance indicators, revenue growth, customer acquisition cost. In government, we look at GDP pay or unemployment
The
rates.
dials and the gauges.
Yeah, these collections of dials and gauges. And if the needle is in the green, we just take a breath, lean back, and assume we're safe. But the central argument of this paper is that the dashboard is, at best, a distraction.
And at worst, a lethal illusion. It's a profound illusion. And before we can even begin to talk about how to intervene in a failing system, we have to kind of look in the mirror. We have to understand the fundamental cognitive mistake we make every time we look at those gauges. The paper formalizes this as the error of reification.
The error of reification, that is a dense term. I want to break that down.
Go for it.
Because to understand reification, we really have to recognize the air we're currently breathing, which the paper calls the control paradigm.
Right, the control paradigm is essentially the industrial scientific method applied to all of reality. It dictates this very specific sequence of actions.
Which is what exactly?
Well, you isolate a variable, measure its current state, and apply targeted force to return it to a desired goals line.
So, like, if you're driving a car and the engine temperature gauge spikes into the red, the control paradigm works perfectly.
Exactly. You pull over, you find the cracked radiator hose, you replace it, you refill the coolant. Temperature drops. Problem solved.
But the paper draws this massive bright line between a system like a car engine and a system like, say, a human body or a global supply chain.
Precisely. Because there is an absolute structural difference between a system that is just complicated and a system that is complex.
Right, the terminology matters there.
Huge difference. A car engine is complicated. It might have thousands of parts, but those parts interact in entirely linear, predictable, fixed ways. You could take an engine apart, lay the pieces on a garage floor, and put them back together.
I mean, good luck trying to do that with a frog.
Right.
You take a frog apart, lay the pieces on a table, and put them back together. You do not have a frog. You have, well, a biological mess.
Because a frog is a complex adaptive system. In a CAS, the behavior of the whole isn't generated by isolated components ticking away in a vacuum.
So how is it generated?
The behavior is generated by highly nonlinear, context-dependent relations. The parts adapt to each other in real time.
Okay, so if I'm tracking with this, the error of reification is basically mistaking the shadow for the object casting it, or mistaking the measurement on the dashboard for the actual underlying reality of the system.
It is conflating an observable state with generative structure.
That sounds like a textbook. What does that actually mean?
Well, the observable state is what the system happens to be doing at this exact millisecond. The generative structure is how the system actually sustains itself and processes energy. When you obsess over a dashboard metric, you're only looking at a tiny, highly compressed observable state.
You're completely blind to the underlying relational web.
Exactly.
Let me see if I can translate this into a real-world scenario. Imagine like a massive tech company. I'm looking at the dashboard, which in this case is the stock price and the quarterly revenue. Both of those lines are going up and to the right. The dashboard is bright green. But what I can't see is that the culture has turned incredibly toxic. Like 80% of the senior engineering team has quietly started interviewing at competitors.
The classic hidden rot.
Right. And the underlying code base is just a tangled disaster held together by duct tape. If I just look at the stock price, I think the company's thriving.
And that is where the danger of the control paradigm becomes acute. Because let's say that stock price starts to dip slightly. What does the control paradigm tell the CEO to do?
Oh, it tells them to push the metric back up, intervene.
Right.
So they announce a massive stock buyback, or they lay off 10% of the staff to make the balance sheet look leaner.
And in doing so, they trigger what Dr. Saley calls the singular squeeze. Because the CEO is applying corrective force to a reified variable, the stock price, they are completely ignoring the actual structural reality of the system.
Oh, wow. So that layoff to boost the stock price might be the exact thing that causes the rest of the senior engineers to finally walk out the door.
Exactly. The CEO applied force to a projection and, in doing so, amplified the hidden internal tensions until the entire structure just fractured.
They squeezed the balloon on one end and it popped on the other.
Yeah.
But what's wild to me is that the dashboard looked fine almost right up to the end. And the paper brings up this concept of critical slowing down, or CSD.
It's a key concept.
This genuinely reframes how I think about failure because, you know, we assume failure is a steady decline, a slow fade. But CSD suggests systems hollow out long before they show it.
Critical slowing down is this fascinating, empirically observable phenomenon across multiple scientific disciplines. Whether you're looking at ecosystems approaching desertification, or financial markets approaching a crash, or human brains approaching an epileptic seizure.
The dashboard metrics often look perfectly stable. They might produce the exact right outputs.
But the foundation is rotting. The internal restoring forces are vanishing. The system is burning through its hidden reserves to maintain that illusion of stability on the dashboard.
Right.
The key indicator of critical slowing down isn't that the average output changes. It's that when a small shock hits, a minor delay, a slight fluctuation, the system takes significantly longer to recover back to its baseline.
The variance increases.
Exactly. The system loses its elasticity.
So if I'm looking at my tech company, the revenue might still be high. But when a minor server outage happens, instead of taking an hour to fix, it takes 3 days because the institutional knowledge is gone. That delayed recovery is the critical slowing down.
Spot on. And the dashboard does not measure the capacity to restore. It only measures the output.
Okay, I have to stop here. Because if the dashboard is lying to us, or at least, as you said, measuring the wrong thing entirely, and if our metrics are actively blinding us to this systemic hollowing out, what on earth are we supposed to be looking at?
It's the million-dollar question.
Right. If I can't look at the blood pressure reading or the stock price or the GDP, how do I actually know if a system is viable?
To do that, the paper argues we have to radically shift our perspective. We have to strip away all the domain-specific details.
Meaning what?
Meaning we have to stop looking at cells or dollars or computer code and distill a system down to its absolute bare minimum. We have to find the fundamental grammar of survival.
The grammar of survival. Okay, this takes us into section 2 of the framework. The minimal grammar of viability. The paper states that to even exist as a viable entity, a system must possess exactly 7 primitives.
Yes. And a primitive, in this context, is an irreducible functional role. You cannot break it down any further or subdivide it without the system losing its basic functional meaning.
So it's the absolute foundation.
Right. If you remove even one of these primitives, you no longer have a complex adaptive system. You just have debris.
Okay, let's list these 7 primitives for you listening. They are constraint, margin, state, disturbance, perception, regulation, and options.
Now, what's fascinating here is the rigorous logic behind that specific number, 7. It's not an arbitrary list Dr. Saley just brainstormed on a napkin. It represents a mathematically complete and irreducible set. Think about what happens if you remove one.
All right, let's test that. Let's say I build a system, but I remove perception.
Well, if your system has no perception, it cannot detect variations in its environment. It is entirely blind.
Right.
The moment the temperature drops, or a predator approaches, or a market shifts, the system cannot register the change. It will just continue its previous behavior until it is destroyed.
Okay, what if I remove margin? Because this one seems incredibly important. Margin is described as latent capacity, like the slack in the system.
A system without margin is a system operating at 100% absolute maximum capacity at all times. It has literally zero buffer.
That sounds stressful.
It's fatal. If you have no margin, the very first disturbance that requires even a fraction of a percent of extra energy will cause immediate catastrophic failure. The system shatters because it cannot absorb variation.
What if you don't have options?
Then your system has no adaptive potential. It might be able to perceive a disturbance. It might even have the margin to survive the initial physical shock. But it has no alternative behaviors to select from to navigate the new reality. It's locked into a single response.
Okay, this makes sense. But my immediate skeptical reaction when reading this was like, why stop at 7? Why not an 8th primitive? What about, I don't know, memory or growth?
The mathematical elegance here is that any 8th primitive you could possibly propose can be entirely expressed as a functional combination of the first 7. Adding an 8th just creates redundancy.
So memory is just...
Memory is just a historical accumulation of states and regulations. 7 is the exact minimal generative set required for a system to be both distinct from its environment and capable of surviving within it.
Okay, so we have our 7 primitives, but a pile of 7 things doesn't actually do anything. And the paper says these primitives cannot exist in isolation or even just in pairs. They have to form triads groups of exactly 3. I really struggled with this initially. Why is a pair not enough?
Because a pairwise relation, just 2 things interacting, defines a mechanism, but it does not define a context. And without context, there is no systemic meaning.
Let me try an analogy here to see if I grasp this. Think about language. If I just have 2 elements, let's say a noun and a verb, dog bites.
Okay.
That is an interaction. Something is happening, but it doesn't give you enough information to understand the reality of the situation. Who did the dog bite? Was it a toy? Was it an intruder? Was it the owner? I need the object. Dog bites man. Now I have a triad, subject, verb, object. That third element provides the functional context that gives the interaction actual meaning.
That is an excellent way to map it. A triad establishes closure. Let's look at how the paper applies this to the primitives. Take the triad of constraint, margin, and state. Dr. Saley calls this the geometry of viability.
Right. Constraint is the boundary, the physical limits of the environment. State is where the system currently resides within those boundaries.
But just knowing the limits and knowing where you are isn't enough. You need the third element, margin. Margin tells you the exact distance between your current state and your absolute constraint. Only by integrating all 3 do you actually know if this system is safe or if it's teetering on the edge of a cliff.
So they have to form triads. But this is where the paper took a massive leap that forced me to reread the section like 3 times. We have 7 primitives. We need to group them into triads. But the rule is that every single pair of primitives must interact exactly once across the entire system with absolutely no redundancy and no missed connections.
It is a profound structural requirement. If you have 7 distinct items, mathematically there are exactly 21 possible unique pairs. To organize 21 pairs into groups of 3 without ever repeating a pairing, you need exactly 7 triads.
7 primitives, 7 triads. And here is the kicker. The paper points out that there is only 1 mathematical structure in the entire universe that can perfectly organize 7 points into 7 lines of 3 without any overlap. It's a concept from finite geometry called the Fano plane.
The Fano plane is a marvel. It is the smallest possible finite projective plane. Visually, if you want to picture it, you can imagine an equilateral triangle.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
That gives you 3 points at the corners and 3 points at the midpoints of the sides. Put the seventh point dead in the center. Now, draw a circle that connects the three midpoints. Every line, including the circle, which acts as a line in this geometry, contains exactly 3 points, and every point connects to every other point exactly once.
Wait, hold on. This is where I have to throw a flag on the play.
Right.
Are you seriously telling me that human societies, with all our messy emotions and irrational politics and biological cells governed by random mutations and a literal concrete wastewater treatment plant, all run on this exact same seven-part Fano-plane geometry? Because that sounds impossibly reductive. It sounds like numerology.
I completely understand the skepticism, but you have to abstract away the material. This isn't about what the system is made of. It is about the structural constraints of existing in a dynamic universe.
Meaning the rules are universal.
The universe does not care if you are made of carbon, silicon, or social contracts. If you want to survive as a distinct entity in a changing environment, you are bound by these rules of closure. Let's look at another triad on the Fano plane. Disturbance, margin, and perception.
The early warning system.
Exactly. A disturbance introduces external variation. The margin absorbs the physical impact of that variation. And the perception detects the deviation within the margin.
And your point is that every viable system must have that exact triad.
Yeah.
Like, a human body has an immune system, which is the margin, and fever receptors, the perception, detecting a virus, which is the disturbance. And a central bank has interest rate buffers as margin and economic data analysts as perception, detecting inflation as the disturbance. The material is totally different, but the geometry is identical.
Precisely. If that triadic structure breaks in either the body or the bank, the system ceases to be viable. The Fano plane proves that all these primitives are globally interdependent. You cannot isolate one variable like a dashboard tries to do without fundamentally breaking the geometry of the entire system.
Okay, I'm with you. The geometry gives us the structure. We have our 7 points pinned to the Fano plane. But a system isn't a drawing on a chalkboard. It isn't static. Systems breathe, they react, they move through time. To understand a system in motion, we have to look at how the order of events changes things.
Which requires us to transition from the static geometry of the Fano plane into the algebra of context. And to make that leap, we have to assign a direction to the lines on our Fano plane. We turn the lines into one-way arrows.
Right. We give the interactions a specific cyclic flow. And the moment you apply directional flow to a Fano plane, something incredible happens. You generate the exact multiplication table for an eight-dimensional number system called the octonions.
The octonions are fascinating.
Yeah.
You have one real number, which essentially represents the scalar magnitude,
yeah,
total amount of energy or mass in the system. And you have seven imaginary units. Those seven imaginary units map perfectly one-to-one with our seven primitives.
And this is where we have to leave the standard, comfortable math of high school behind. Because octonions behave very, very strangely. The first property the paper highlights is that they are anti-commutative.
Right.
In normal math, order doesn't matter. 2 times 3 is 6. 3 times 2 is 6. But in octonian math, A times B does not equal B times A. The order completely flips the outcome.
Anti-commutativity is the mathematical formalization of directional meaning. In a complex system, an interaction is not a two-way street. The effect of primitive A acting upon primitive B is structurally different than B acting upon A.
Give me a tangible example of that.
Think about disturbance and state. A disturbance acting upon your state, say the sudden storm hitting a ship, forces the ship to physically adapt to survive.
Right.
But your state acting upon a disturbance, say the ship's massive hull breaking the waves, alters the nature of the storm's impact. The sequence dictates the reality.
Okay. Order matters. But the octonions have an even weirder, much more disruptive property. They are non-associative, meaning how you group the interactions changes the final result. Mathematically, it means taking A and B together and then adding C is fundamentally unequal to taking A and adding the combination of B and C.
This is arguably the single most important algebraic property in the entire framework. Non-associativity is the rigorous mathematical proof of path dependence.
Path dependence, right.
In a complicated system, like a car engine, sequence can often be ignored. You can swap the spark plugs, then change the oil. Or change the oil, then swap the spark plugs. The final state of the car is identical.
It's associative.
Yes. But in a complex adaptive system, the path you take permanently irreversibly alters the fabric of the system. You cannot ignore intermediate states.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Let me try to build an analogy here, because non-associativity is a beast of a concept. My go-to is baking. Let's say A is flour, B is raw eggs, and C is a hot frying pan.
Okay, I like this. Let's trace the groupings.
If I group A and B first, I mix the flour and the raw eggs together. I get a batter. Then I introduce C, the hot pan. The result is a pancake, a unified functional whole.
Well, sounds delicious.
Right. But what if I change the grouping? What if I group B and C together first? I crack the raw eggs into the hot pan. I instantly get scrambled eggs.
Naturally.
Then I introduce A, the flour. I pour raw flour over cooked eggs. I don't get a pancake. I get a gross, powdery mess of scrambled eggs. The elements are exactly the same. The amount of energy is the same. But the grouping completely dictated the final reality.
That is a phenomenal analogy.
Right.
And it maps perfectly to how interventions work or fail in complex systems like public policy or corporate management.
Let's do a corporate one then. Think about a massive merger.
Yeah.
Company A acquires Company B. They spend a year integrating their cultures and their software. It's a bloodbath, but they finally stabilize into a new single entity. Then they acquire Company C. They can probably handle it. But what if Company B and Company C merge first, form their own weird subculture, and then Company A tries to buy that combined mess? The resulting friction would tear the corporation apart.
And Dr. Saifliya provides a mathematical tool to actually measure that exact friction. It's called the associator. The associator literally measures the difference, the gap, between one grouping and the other.
So the associator measures the difference between the pancake and the flour-covered scrambled egg.
Yes. It measures the obstruction. The paper calls this relational friction.
And I want to emphasize for you listening, this friction isn't just a quirky math artifact. It represents actual real-world waste and destruction.
Absolutely. If the associator does not equal zero, your interactions are obstructed. In the physical world, that obstruction manifests as metabolic cost. Your body burns extra calories fighting itself. In a corporation, it's the thousands of engineering hours wasted trying to integrate two software platforms that fundamentally reject each other. In government, it is institutional capacity completely consumed by bureaucratic infighting and contradictory regulations. It is energy lost to the void.
Which means we can definitively mathematically prove that classical control is impossible in a complex adaptive system. You can't just apply force to a metric because the sheer relational friction of how and when you apply that force will alter the system in wildly unpredictable ways. Control relies entirely on the assumption of associativity. Complex systems are non-associative. Therefore, the control paradigm is fundamentally incompatible with reality.
That is the inescapable conclusion. We have to abandon the illusion of control and embrace navigation.
Okay. We know that down at the microscopic level, interactions are full of friction, path dependence, and context. The Octonians prove that. But here is my issue. An economy or a human immune system isn't just three things interacting, it's millions of things. The Octonians only measure local, small-scale interactions. If I want to know if my entire 10,000-person company is going to survive the year, how on earth do I see the whole board at once without my brain melting?
That exact problem is why the mathematics has to level up. We need a conceptual container massive enough to hold the entirety of the system's states and all of its non-associative relations simultaneously. And to do that, we move from the Octonians to something called the Albert algebra.
The Albert algebra. It sounds like an eccentric British professor, but it's actually a 27-dimensional matrix. Specifically, it is a 3x3 matrix where every single entry inside the matrix is an Octonian.
The Albert algebra is a breathtaking mathematical object. It reorganizes our local microscopic algebra of context into a macroscopic global architecture. It shows us the state, the coherence, and the hidden vulnerabilities of the entire system. To make this 27-dimensional matrix intuitive, you just have to look at how it separates into two distinct parts.
Right. If you picture a 3x3 grid, you have a diagonal line running from the top left to the bottom right, and then you have the six boxes that sit outside that diagonal line, the off diagonals. Let's break down what those represent in reality. The diagonal of this matrix represents scalar capacities.
Scalar capacity is what the system possesses. It is the raw material. If you're looking at a national economy, the diagonal is the total capital, the labor force size, the raw natural resources. In an ecosystem is the total volume of water and the raw biomass.
Okay, so what are the off diagonals?
The off diagonals represent the relational flows. This is how the capacities actually interact and exchange information or energy with one another.
Let's make that tangible. If my capacity, my diagonal, is a hospital with 500 beds and 100 doctors, what is the off-diagonal flow?
The flow is the communication delay between the emergency room triage and the surgical ward. It is the supply chain efficiency delivering saline from the loading dock to the ICU. It is the shift handoff protocols between the nurses. The diagonal is the stuff. The off-diagonal is how the stuff moves.
And this distinction is where the dashboard illusion gets completely exposed, because what the Albert algebra shows us mathematically is that a system can have massive, robust capacities, huge numbers on the diagonal, but entirely fail because the relational flows, the off-diagonals, are blocked or misaligned.
And think about our dashboards from earlier. What do they measure?
They almost exclusively measure the diagonal. They measure what you have, GDP, total revenue, bed count.
Exactly. They completely miss the relational flows. You can have a hospital with 500 beds and world-class surgeons, but if the communication flow between the lab and the ER is obstructed, the hospital ceases to function as a viable healing environment. Patients die while the dashboard says the hospital is fully staffed.
Wow. So to measure the true integrated health of the system, the combination of capacity and flow, we calculate something called the determinant of this 3x3 matrix.
Yes. The determinant of the Albert algebra matrix is the system's structural coherence. Large capacity increases coherence, but large relational flows can actually aggressively reduce coherence if they are chaotic, uncoordinated, or generating friction.
But the determinant isn't even the coolest part of this matrix. The paper introduces a tool hidden inside the Albert algebra that absolutely blew my mind. It's called the adjoint map.
The adjoint map, denoted mathematically as A sharp. Because the Albert algebra is so symmetrically perfect, taking the adjoint of this state matrix reveals what Dr. Sinkley terms the structural shadow.
The structural shadow. I want to spend a minute on this because it is the key to everything. The structural shadow is a mathematical map of latent, invisible vulnerabilities.
It is derived directly from the system's current state, but it exposes realities that the diagonal dashboard completely obscures. It shows you exactly where the internal flows are locally overloaded. It highlights the invisible contradictions.
Let me build out an analogy for the structural shadow. Imagine a massive, beautiful skyscraper. You are the building inspector. You walk up to it, and the dashboard, the diagonal, looks incredible. It has 2 million square feet of space. It has high-speed elevators. The lobby is made of marble. From the outside, looking at the observable state, it is a triumph of engineering.
But the adjoint map is the blueprint showing you the internal stress loads.
Exactly. The structural shadow is a map that shows you that on the 14th floor, deep inside the walls, three of the primary steel load-bearing pillars are actively rusting, and they are currently carrying 400% more weight than they were designed for because of a misaligned concrete pour on the roof. The building looks totally fine right now, but the shadow tells you exactly which pillar will violently snap the moment a 4-magnitude earthquake hits.
That is precisely how it functions. The observable state can appear entirely stable, while the generative structure is silently failing. The structural shadow proves this is a mathematical certainty in complex systems. You can have high capacity, but the adjoint map reveals negative residual capacity and completely unsustainable flow patterns.
Having a map of the structure and its shadow is incredible. It feels like a superpower. But a skyscraper doesn't exist in a vacuum. It faces wind shear, it faces gravity, it has thousands of people moving around inside it, changing the weight distribution. The 27-dimensional Albert algebra gives us the building. But we need to put the building in a living environment. We have to look at the system dynamically under pressure.
And that necessity brings us to the final mathematical lift of the paper. We move from the 27 dimensions of state into a 56-dimensional phase space known as the Freudenthal triple system.
Okay, 56 dimensions. I can barely park my car in 3 dimensions. The moment I read 56-dimensional phase space, my instinct was to close the PDF. But let's break this down because the paper actually makes it incredibly intuitive. It's not 56 physical directions, it's degrees of freedom. And in this phase space, every viable system in the universe can be mapped as a single vector with exactly 4 parts, alpha, A, B, beta.
Let's clearly define those 4 components. The first is alpha. This is the systemic load. It represents the external pressure, the environmental demands, the stress placed on the system. It is everything the system is being forced to carry or process.
Next is A, the structural state. Yeah. This is the 27-dimensional Albert algebra matrix we just built. It is the building. It's what the system currently is.
Then we have B, the adaptive engine. This is mathematically dual to the structure. It represents the regulatory processes, the control mechanisms, the repair protocols. It is what the system can do to respond to the load.
And finally, beta. systemic reserve, the redundancy, the buffering capacity, the stored energy, the slack. It is what the system can draw upon when things go wrong.
What is essential to grasp here is the continuous tension and duality between these elements. Look at A, the structure, versus B, the adaptability. Viability requires a dynamic alignment between them. If you build a system with an incredibly rigid, strong structure, it's a strong A but terrible adaptability, a weak B, that system is brittle. It cannot bend, so it will eventually shatter under a novel load.
Like a massive oak tree in a hurricane. It's strong, but it snaps.
Conversely, if you have a system with hyperactive adaptability, a strong B, but a very weak underlying structure, a weak A, that system is chaotic and unstable. It will tear itself apart trying to respond to every minor breeze.
Let me bring this down to a human level, because I mapped my own life onto this 56-dimensional equation, and it was deeply revealing. Think about yourself listening to this. Alpha is your systemic load. That's your massive project at work, your daily commute, the stress of paying your mortgage. A is your structural state, your physical body, your current health. B is your adaptive engine. These are your coping mechanisms. Going to the gym, meditating, talking to a therapist, or maybe drinking a glass of wine. And beta is your systemic reserve. That is your bank account, your sleep deficit, your baseline mental health.
That is a perfect, valid mapping. So what happens when you alter the balance of that equation?
Well, let's say alpha, my stress load at work, spikes dramatically because of a deadline. And let's say beta, my reserve is completely drained because I haven't slept in 3 days and my bank account is empty. I have massive load, zero reserve.
What does your system do?
My adaptive engine, B, has to go into overdrive. I'm trying to meditate furiously between meetings. I'm drinking 4 cups of coffee. Maybe I drink 3 glasses of wine at night instead of one just to force myself to calm down. I am spending massive amounts of energy just trying to cope. And eventually, because my structure, A, can't handle the friction of that hyperactive engine, my body breaks down. I get sick.
Precisely. You experience systemic collapse. The scalar balance between your load, alpha, and your reserve, beta, determines the sheer survival constraints of your reality. And the relational balance between your structure, A, and your adaptation, B, determines your freedom to move within those constraints.
We finally have all the pieces on the board. We understand the load, the structure, the engine, and the reserve. Now, how do we calculate the single ultimate metric that tells us if this 56-dimensional entity is going to survive the week or if it's going to collapse? Enter the altimeter.
The altimeter.
Yeah.
This is the master equation of Dr. Sehaly's entire framework. It is mathematically defined as delta, which is the quartic invariant of the E7 Lie group.
The E7 quartic invariant. All right, let's de-jargon this. Why does the paper insist on calling it an invariant, and why is that distinction so crucial?
It is the most important distinction we can make. A dashboard metric, like a stock price or blood pressure reading, is just a variable. Variables fluctuate wildly. They change depending on who is holding the ruler, what time of day it is, or what scale you are using. They are relative.
But an invariant.
An invariant describes a fundamental underlying structural property that is preserved through any transformation. It doesn't matter what angle you look at the system from or how fast it is moving, the invariant remains absolutely true. It is objective reality. Delta mathematically integrates the systemic load, the structure, the adaptation, and the reserve into one single global measure of relational coherence.
And reading this altimeter is incredibly straightforward. It gives us 3 distinct regimes of reality. If delta is greater than 0, your system is viable. It possesses enough structural coherence to sustain its functions and adapt to its environment.
If delta reaches exactly 0, you have hit the critical boundary. This is the mathematical singularity. Internal restoring forces have completely vanished. The system has 0 elasticity left. Collapse is imminent and mathematically unavoidable.
And if delta drops below 0, the system is formally non-viable. Its underlying relational geometry has shattered. Now, it might look fine on the outside for a few more days, coasting on momentum or being propped up by artificial external life support, but structural death has already occurred.
So the goal of any intervention is to keep delta as far above 0 as possible. But to do that, we have to look at how delta is actually calculated. The paper decomposes this master invariant into a battle between 2 main competing forces, phase margin minus coherence burden.
Let's break this down. Phase margin, denoted as M star.
Phase margin is the actual usable slack in your system. It is what you have left in the tank after you balance your environmental load and your stored reserve against your physical structure and your adaptive engine. It's your freedom to maneuver.
And coherence burden, C star, is the cost of doing business. It is the metabolic and relational cost of maintaining your complex structure while under load.
And here is where we hit what I think is the most profound counterintuitive realization in the entire paper, the trying harder paradox.
Yes. This fundamentally challenges everything we are taught about resilience and management.
Mm.
Because standard logic says that if a system is struggling under pressure, the adaptive engine, B, needs to spin up and work harder to overcome the obstacle.
Push through it. That's what we are told. If the company is missing targets, make the sales team work weekends. If you are exhausted, drink more coffee and grind harder. But the math of the E7 invariant proves that this is suicidal. The paper shows that if your systemic load alpha is already maxed out and your reserve beta is low, deploying more complex coping mechanisms actually decreases your overall viability.
Because every time your adaptive engine fires, it generates friction. It spikes your coherence burden.
You're spending energy just to manage the fact that you were spending energy.
The paper calls this the load trap. When the relational cost of adaptation is high, adding more load or forcing the system to try harder forces the system to compensate locally. It might fix the immediate symptom, but the massive spike in coherence burden is draining the system globally. The delta plummets toward zero.
This is revolutionary. We are mathematically proving that trying harder when you have no reserve destroys you. Think about a startup running out of runway. The founders panic. They start working 100-hour weeks. They launch 3 new product lines simultaneously to try and save the company. Their adaptive engine is screaming. But because they have no margin, the sheer burden of coordinating those chaotic actions burns through their remaining cash twice as fast. They make terrible decisions due to sleep deprivation, and the company implodes months earlier than it would have.
If you apply more control, more regulation, or more force when a system is already caught in the load trap, you actively accelerate its collapse.
Exactly.
So if trying harder doesn't work, if applying force breaks the geometry, if the dashboard is a lie, how do we actually intervene in a failing system and save it?
We have to completely abandon the control paradigm and adopt what Dr. Saheli calls the calculus of navigation.
Calculus. That word triggers high school trauma for a lot of people, but here it's really just about finding gradients, right? We compute the differential gradient of delta to delta, and that gradient points us toward the exact direction of maximum viability increase within our 56-dimensional space.
Exactly. A scalar value, like the altimeter delta, tells you where you currently are. The gradient tells you which direction to step. And this calculus reveals what the paper terms the Wu-Wei vector.
So what does this all mean? I love this. Wu Wei is an ancient Taoist philosophical concept. It roughly translates to non-forcing or effortless action. It's often misunderstood as doing nothing. But here, it is not a mystical metaphor. It is a rigorously defined mathematical vector.
It is the precise mathematical direction of minimal applied force yielding maximal coherence gain. It means finding the path of least relational friction through the phase space. You do not fight the load directly. You do not attack the symptom. You follow the gradient.
And the math isolates exactly what the most universally regenerative action in the universe is. It is a mathematical term called a joint alignment.
A joint alignment is represented as the inner product pairing of the system's structural shadow, A sharp, with its adaptive shadow, B sharp. Let me explain why this is the holy grail of intervention. It is the only mathematical term in the entire calculus that unconditionally increases your viability, delta, without increasing your coherence burden.
Let me try to translate that into plain English. A joint alignment means you must stop matching your adaptive engine to the external load. You stop fighting the fire directly. Instead, you match your adaptation to your system's structural shadow, its latent, hidden vulnerabilities.
Precisely. If you target the load, you are being reactive. You are just spinning your engine to fight the environment, which increases your burden.
Yeah.
But if you align your interventions to heal the structural shadow, you're resolving internal contradictions. You are greasing the gears. You're removing friction from the off diagonals.
It's the building inspector ignoring the earthquake, the load, and instead reinforcing the rusted pillar on the 14th floor, the shadow. By doing that, the building survives the earthquake effortlessly.
It is the only intervention that mathematically guarantees you won't trigger the singular squeeze.
Okay, this theory is breathtakingly elegant on paper. But math on a whiteboard is one thing. Dr. Saheli goes a massive step further. He maps this exact 56-dimensional E7 invariant onto 3 vastly different complex real-world domains. I want us to look at the cross-domain evidence. Let's start with clinical medicine.
Specifically, the paper examines congestive heart failure. Let's map the variables. Alpha, the load, is the hemodynamic stress, the sheer volume of blood and the vascular resistance the heart has to push against.
A, the structure, is the physical myocardium, the heart muscle itself, its chambers, its valves.
B, the adaptive engine, is the neurohormonal regulatory system. This is the body releasing adrenaline, activating the sympathetic nervous system to modulate the heart rate. And beta, the reserve, is the cellular metabolic capacity and energy stores of the heart tissue.
And the structural shadow, A-sharp.
The shadow reveals phenomena like ventricular wall stress, subendocardial ischemia, and gross energy inefficiency. These are catastrophic vulnerabilities that are entirely invisible to a standard dashboard metric, like the ejection fraction, until the heart is literally on the verge of stopping.
So what is the trap? A patient comes into the ER, their heart is failing, the dashboard shows that cardiac output is dangerously low. What does the control paradigm dictate the doctor should do?
The reflex of the control paradigm is to give the patient inotropes. Inotropes are drugs that chemically force the heart muscle to contract harder and faster.
You are literally commanding the heart to try harder.
Exactly. You are chemically forcing the variable back to the baseline.
Yeah.
And what happens? The cardiac output spikes. The dashboard turns green. The doctor thinks they solved the problem. But mathematically, what has they done? They have massively spiked the metabolic coherence burden. They forced a failing structure to burn through its final remaining reserves, beta.
The system decompensates faster, viability drops. The patient dies a few days later, even though the dashboard looked great on Tuesday.
So what is the Wu-Wei vector here? How do you navigate a failing heart?
You don't whip the tired horse?
No. You reduce the load. You administer diuretics to remove fluid volume, or vasodilators to open the pipes and lower the resistance. You give the heart room to breathe. And you achieve a joint alignment by using medications like beta blockers, which actually inhibit the neurohormonal overdrive. You quiet the adaptive engine so the structural shadow can heal and the tissue can remodel.
That is mind-blowing. Okay, let's instantly pivot to a domain that couldn't seem more different. Process engineering, specifically municipal wastewater treatment plants. These are giant concrete vats of raw sewage, but mathematically they are classic complex adaptive systems.
Let's map it. Alpha, the load, is the influence shock. The millions of gallons of raw, toxic sewage suddenly entering the plant after a storm. A, the structure, is the biological reactor. It's the immensely complex microbial ecology, the billions of bacteria that actually eat and break down the waste.
B, the adaptive engine, is the plant operator turning dials, adjusting aeration rates, returning sludge, or dosing chemicals. And beta, the reserve, is the physical buffering capacity of the holding tanks, or the excess age of the sludge.
A massive toxic shock load hits the plant. The bacteria get highly stressed. The structural shadow, if we could see it, which shows severe biofilm instability and enzyme inhibition. The bacteria are dying. But the plant manager doesn't see that. They only look at the dashboard, the effluent quality KPI that the environmental regulator monitors.
The KPI starts to drift out of compliance. The manager panics. What is the control paradigm trap?
The trap is to dump massive quantities of chemical coagulants into the water to artificially bind the waste and meet the KPI.
They fix the reified variable. The water coming out of the pipe looks clean. The dashboard is green. But what actually happened inside the tank?
The chemical coagulants completely devastate the already stressed microbial ecology. They alter the pH. They strip nutrients. The operator increased the adaptive burden, entirely collapsed the biological reserve, and the plant's delta plummets. The next day, the entire biological system crashes and raw sewage flows into the river.
So what is the Wu-Wei vector for a wastewater plant?
You build massive equalization basins. You increase physical storage to smooth out the incoming load alpha. You stop relying on brute force chemicals to fix a biological problem. You cannot chemically compensate for an ecological misalignment. You have to nurture the structure.
We have mapped this onto a human organ and a bacterial vat. Now we move to the third domain, governance. And I need to insert a massive blinking disclaimer here for you listening. As your hosts, we are strictly 100% reporting the mathematical mappings exactly as they are defined in Dr. Sahili's peer-reviewed paper. We are not taking a political stance. We are not endorsing a policy. We are looking at the architecture of human civilization purely through the lens of a 56-dimensional geometric invariant.
It is absolutely crucial to remain objective here.
Yeah.
In governance, the mapping is profound. Alpha, the systemic load, represents macroeconomic pressures, debt burdens, and wealth inequality. A, the structure, is the institutional framework, the courts, the legal systems, the constitution.
B, the adaptive engine, is policymaking, bureaucratic intervention, and regulation. And beta, the systemic reserve, maps directly to social trust, ecological capital, and fiscal space.
Now look at the structural shadow, A-sharp. The shadow reveals the hidden rot in a society. the erosion of democratic legitimacy, deep institutional strain, pervasive systemic bias. These are fundamental vulnerabilities that a dashboard metric like GDP or stock market highs will completely mask.
So what does the failure trajectory of a civilization look like mathematically? It looks exactly like the failing heart. Load increases due to unchecked inequality or debt. Because of that load, social trust, the reserve, beta begins to evaporate. So what does the government do when things feel unstable?
It fires up the adaptive engine, it increases regulation, it imposes austerity.
The control paradigm trap. When inequality is high and public trust is at rock bottom, the state reflex is to tighten control. To enforce compliance through policing or bureaucratic red tape to try and force the society back into balance.
But according to the mathematics of the E7 invariant, applying more regulation or control when systemic load is critical and reserve is depleted simply spikes the coherence burden. It forces a society to spend all its remaining relational energy managing internal contradictions and friction. The dashboard, maybe it's the inflation rate or the deficit, might stabilize for a moment, but the structural coherence, the delta, is actively collapsing towards zero.
You are giving inotropes to a failing society. You are whipping the horse. So what is the mathematical Wu-Wei vector for an entire civilization?
You must reduce the systemic load. Mathematically, that means directly alleviating the pressures of inequality or debt. You must rebuild reserve, which means restoring public trust, investing in the ecological commons, and creating social safety nets. And you must achieve a joint alignment. You align policy not to optimize a dashboard metric like GDP, but to heal the actual structural realities and latent vulnerabilities of the population.
It is genuinely awe-inspiring. Whether you are a cardiologist looking at a heart, an engineer looking at a tank of bacteria, or a policymaker looking at a nation, the geometry of collapse is identical. It is an absolute isomorphism. You cannot regulate your way out of a biological failure, and you cannot medicate your way out of a structural one.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the failure trajectory is an invariant path. Load increases, reserve drops, adaptive effort spikes, coherence drops, delta approaches zero. The trap is always the exact same cognitive error. The hubristic belief that we can compensate for a deep structural misalignment by applying force to a variable on a dashboard.
Seeing civilizations mapped right alongside biological cells forces a massive perspective shift. It forces us to ask a much deeper, almost philosophical question about how we value our world. And that brings us to the final section of our deep dive, toward a general theory of coherence.
This is where the mathematics transcends mere operational modeling and touches on fundamental ethics. The paper definitively asserts that viability requires reserve. Beta must be protected. But look at the modern systems we have built. We are entirely obsessed with optimization and efficiency.
Right. We worship efficiency. Just in time, global supply chains that have zero inventory in warehouses, running hospitals at 99% capacity to maximize shareholder profit, stripping away public safety nets and buffers to lower taxes.
The optimization mindset views reserve as waste. It views slack as a financial inefficiency to be eradicated. But from the perspective of the E7 invariant, liquidating your reserve is a mathematical catastrophe.
Because without reserve, you have no phase margin. The very first time an unpredicted disturbance hits, a global pandemic, a sudden financial shock, a massive hurricane, the system has absolutely no buffer to absorb it. It shatters.
This raises an important question about our civilizational design. Within Dr. Saley's framework, ethics ceases to be a subjective moral debate. Ethics becomes geometry. Actions that preserve human life, that restore ecological reserve, that build social trust, they are not just morally good in a fuzzy qualitative sense. They are the rigorous mathematical prerequisites for the structural coherence of the system.
Ethics as geometry. Yeah. I want you to really sit with that thought. It means that caring for the vulnerable, protecting the environment, ensuring people have a buffer against poverty, these aren't just nice charitable ideas. They were the mathematical baseline required for a society to avoid collapsing into a singularity.
And this demands that we understand indirect causality. In complex systems, you rarely solve a problem by attacking it head on. If you have a weed in your garden, ripping off the leaves doesn't kill the weed, it grows back. You have to change the relational conditions of the soil. You solve problems by navigating the gradient, reducing the systemic load, and building the reserve.
Coherence versus optimization. That is a battle of our century. Optimization is playing a video game to maximize your high score in the next 5 minutes, even if it means permanently breaking the controller. Coherence is playing the game in a way that ensures you are allowed to keep playing it tomorrow and the next day. Efficiency is brittle. Coherence is viable.
Exactly. A society or a corporation that systematically strips away its buffers in the name of short-term efficiency is mathematically accelerating its own delta towards zero. Coherence, not optimization, must become our fundamental civilizational goal.
Okay, let's take a deep breath. Let's synthesize this incredible journey we've been on. We started by identifying the deadly illusion of the dashboard. We realized that trying to control complex systems by forcing isolated variables leads directly to the singular squeeze and catastrophic collapse.
We stripped viability down to its grammar. Seven primitives forming triads on the Fano plane. We gave them direction, revealing the Octonians, which mathematically prove that context and sequence matter, that complex systems are non-associative, and interventions are path-dependent.
From there, we lifted our perspective into the 27-dimensional Albert algebra to discover our structural shadow, the map of our hidden catastrophic vulnerabilities. Then we made the final jump into 56 dimensions, mapping the Freudenthal triple system to balance load, structure, adaptation, and reserve.
Which ultimately delivered our altimeter, delta, the E7 quartic invariant. We learned the danger of the trying harder paradox and discovered that survival requires following the Wu-Wei vector, minimizing our burden, and targeting the structural shadow through a joint alignment.
But the paper leaves us with one final, deeply provocative horizon to look toward. Because the math doesn't actually stop at E7, does it?
No, it does not. Beyond E7 lies E8. It is the largest exceptional Lie group in existence. In this framework, E8 is not an operational metric. You don't build a dashboard for E8, and you don't calculate it to save your company. It's a horizon concept. It suggests the ultimate beautiful mathematical symmetry of maximal relational closure. While E7 gives us the calculus to navigate our messy reality, E8 suggests that the universe itself, at its highest level, is fundamentally bound by profound ultimate relational integration. Everything in the end is connected in a perfectly coherent whole.
Think about the complex systems in your own life right now, the team you manage at work, your family dynamic, your own physical and mental health. Ask yourself, are you staring at a dashboard, obsessing over a metric and trying to force it into the green? Are you tightening that leaky pipe until the water heater explodes?
Or are you brave enough to look at your structural shadow?
Are you actively building your reserve? Are you doing the hard work to reduce your load? Are you taking the path of the Wu-Wei vector, finding the effortless aligned action that actually restores coherence? It might just be time to throw away the dashboard and start checking your altimeter.